The Word of God teaches that the children of God are to be different. A simple illustration is the Bible says, love not the world. Now, the particulars of that depends on the preacher. I've heard that preached and all kinds of things got applied. I got saved in a church in Florida that was a Baptist church, but so many years ago that they had their little list of don'ts. They called it the Filthy Five and the Nasty Nine or the Dirty Dozen, but they had the little list, and we were different. We didn't go to movies. We were different. We didn't play cards. We were different. We didn't go, and this term always fascinated me. We didn't practice mixed bathing. Now, what they meant was mixed swimming, but they called it mixed bathing. You remember those times? Well, anyway, we're supposed to be different. I think we all agree with that. The question is, what does that mean? How are we to be different? Now, there are just a number of different ways that we are to be different, which I will get to by and by. But what I want to do is go to the book of Leviticus, where it gives some very strange laws. And it is obvious that God is giving the ancient Jews these laws because they were to be different, as I will explain as we go through the passage. This passage does not directly apply to us, but the principle of their doing this because he wants them to be different does apply to us, and I will show you how we are to be different when I get to the end. But first, let's look at Leviticus chapter 15. Leviticus chapter 15. Now, let me explain that this is the section of the book of Leviticus where Moses is talking about being ceremonially unclean. It started back in chapter 11, and it extends through chapter 15. In chapter 11, it was possible that because of concerning animals that you could become unclean for a long time, permanently. In chapter 12, it had to do with childbirth, and you were ceremonially unclean for 8 days. In chapter 13 and 14, those two chapters are one long unit, it was a skin disease, and that skin disease rendered you ceremonially unclean, and there were various time limits involved depending on the nature of the disease. What we're going to do in chapter 15 is talk about discharges of the human body that are associated with the reproductive system. Now, this is going to strike you as strange as it did me. I think as I look at this chapter, I'm going to say some of the bluntest things about the human body that I have ever said in the pulpit. That reminds me of something that happened to me a long time ago. Many, many years ago, I announced that I was going to preach through the book of Galatians. Now, admittedly, that was a different day. Probably wouldn't affect people today, but I remember somebody being very, very conservative and sensitive saying, "You're going to do what? I'm going to preach through the book of Galatians. How are you going to handle publicly talking about circumcision?" It had never occurred to me that that was a problem until she brought it up. And then I thought, I'm going to do it just the way the Bible does it. I'm going to stand up in the pulpit and read it. They all know what circumcision is. And I did, and I've done it many times since. Well, this is probably a little beyond that. So this needs a warning. You know when you watch some TV programs and it says viewer discretion advised? Well, I'm tempted to say listener discretion is advised, because this is going to get graphic. You ready? You say, oh yeah, that just made it more interesting. What in the world are you talking about? All right, let me explain. Leviticus chapter 15 talks about four different situations. Two involve men and two involve women. In each case of each gender, one case of the male has to do with some kind of a disease he might have. And the second case pertaining to the male is there's no disease involved. It's natural. Now, likewise, with the woman, a similar kind of thing seems to be what's going on. At any rate, the chapter consists of four types of things that can happen to the human body that renders it, as far as Moses is concerned, ceremonially unclean. So, with all of that in mind, turn to Leviticus chapter 15 and look at verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean. Now, it is apparent from reading the rest of the chapter in context that this is a running discharge, probably resulting from a disease. As a matter of fact, a number of commentators would even go so far as to say that it's dealing with gonorrhea. At any rate, there's a male discharge. Verse 3 says, and this shall be his uncleanness in regarding to his discharge, whether his body runs with his discharge or his body is stopped up by his discharge. It is his uncleanness. Every bed is unclean on which he has discharged, he who has the discharge lies. And everything on which he sits shall be unclean. In other words, if he sat in a chair, anything he sat on, the bed, saddle of a horse, that chair, bed, saddle would be unclean. So he says in verse 5, whoever touches his bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. He who sits on anything on which he who has the discharge sat shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And he who touches the body of him who has the discharge shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean. If he has discharge, he who has the discharge spits on him who is clean, then he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Any saddle on which he who has the discharge rides shall be unclean. Whoever touches anything that was under him shall be unclean until evening. He who carries any of these things shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, and be unclean until evening. And whomever the one who has the discharge touches and has not rinsed his hands in water, he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean. Clean. A lot of repetition in that passage. Couple of very simple observations. In the first place, he has this discharge from his body, and that renders him unclean and anything he touches. That's the simple point of the passage. It includes him spitting on somebody. I can't imagine why he would do that, but it includes that. So he and anything he touches is unclean. The second observation is that he's only unclean until evening. Now, at the beginning, I mentioned that Leviticus chapter 11 all the way through 15 It's talking about various things that render you ceremonially unclean and their very lengths of time for the uncleanness. So that this is relatively short. You could be unclean for 8 days. You could be unclean for a lot longer. So just being unclean until evening is real short as compared to the context of the book. At any rate, it says in verse 12, the vessels of the earth that he who has the discharge touches shall be broken, and every vessel of wood shall be rinsed in water. Now, this is slightly different, but it's, again, rendering something unclean, only in this case, instead of washing it, it was to be broken. So, as someone has pointed out, the major concern was the man's ceremonial uncleanness and its consequences, because other people and objects he came in contact with also became ceremonially unclean. So his bed, his chair, his spittle, his person, his saddle could all be rendered unclean ceremonially. In this sense, his uncleanness was more infectious than his skin disease. Or from an unclean animal, mentioned way back in chapter 11, which was limited to direct contact. However, since a man with a chronic discharge was not isolated outside the camp, as was the case in chapter 13, his uncleanness was apparently less serious than one affected, say, with a skin disease. In chapter 13, you have a skin disease, you are outside the camp. In this case, you're just unclean until evening. So, one possible conclusion that could be drawn from all of this is that the purpose of the uncleanness was not primarily hygienic, but it was, in the words of one scholar, religious and theological. And I am personally persuaded that is correct, that this has nothing to do with hygiene. And the reason that gets brought up is because the solution is to wash your clothes. But this isn't for hygienic purposes. It is for a theological or religious purpose, so to speak, to teach a spiritual lesson. That's the issue. All right. Now, what we've talked about so far is the disease and the uncleanness. Let's look at the cleansing. Pick it up at verse 13. And when he has a discharge, is cleansed of his discharge, then he shall count for himself 7 days for his cleansing, wash his clothes, and bathe his body in running water. Then he shall be clean. On the 8th day, he shall take for himself 2 turtle doves and 2 young pigeons and come before the Lord to the door of the tabernacle of meeting and give them to the priest. Then the priest shall offer them, the one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering. So the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord because of his discharge. So, if the idea that this section of Leviticus 15 is talking about gonorrhea, then this is pertaining to that. The uncleanness of these discharges caused less serious rituals that were associated with the skin disease. He could live at home. He didn't have to move outside the camp. He just had to wash and be unclean until evening. He did not have to go through a more elaborate ceremony, but he did need 2 inexpensive sacrifices. Hence, the problem of a person with a discharge. That's the key here in the whole chapter. It is a discharge of some kind, and apparently this one has to do with a man who has a disease. The next section, beginning in verse 16, is still talking about a male discharge, only this time it is not related to a disease. So he says in verse 16, if any man has an emission of semen, then he shall wash all his body in water and be unclean until evening. All right. Again, there is the purification process does not involve a sacrifice, only washing and waiting until evening. Now, from verses 16 to 18, there is the bodily admission of semen that seems to be involuntary. At verse 18, it's voluntary. At any rate, there is the release of semen. So he says in verse 17, and any garment, any leather on which there is semen, it should be washed with water and should be unclean until evening. Again, notice, no sacrifice, just the simple washing and waiting. Then it says in verse 18, also, when a woman lies with a man and there is admission of semen, they shall both bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Oh boy, getting more and more interesting. These two are just participating in natural, normal marital relationships. The practical effect of this was that the man, when the man had religious duties to perform, whether it was involved in worship or participation in God's holy wars, sexual intercourse was not permitted. That's the net effect of what's going on here. One author says, one valuable feature of this legislation that had an important bearing on Israel's social life and religious life was the rule that made partners unclean for the whole day. This separated sexual activity from worship in a unique manner, and this precluded any futility rite that was to be part of the religious among the people, such as was practiced by the Canaanites. Furthermore, the continuous state of ceremonial uncleanness experienced by the prostitutes in Israel will remove any possibility of her participation in Hebrew worship and take away any approaching respectability from her life, if indeed she was at all sensitive to the requirements of this law. Now, end of quote. Let me explain. What this author is suggesting, and others have as well, is that in ancient times, sexual acts were part of the worship. That permeated the ancient world. There were temple prostitutes, and part of the worship ritual was having sex with a prostitute. I remember being in Corinth the first time, and the guide was touring us around, and outside of the city, there is a hill. Matter of fact, a lot of Greek cities were like that, and the guide was pointing out that up there on the top of that hill, the city of Corinth was down at the bottom of it, was a temple, and they practiced prostitution as part of the worship. So sexual intercourse was part of pagan worship. Matter of fact, that really drives home what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, that they were visiting prostitutes. That's his point in one passage in 1 Corinthians. So it is suggested that what Moses is prohibiting is to demonstrate very clearly, you are different. You don't do that. That's not part of the worship of Yahweh. That's not part of the worship. There's nothing sinful about that. It's just I'm emphasizing it's not part of the worship. So, someone has said God was saying very clearly that sex, any aspect of sex, any bodily function connection with sex, had to be completely apart from the holy place. He was not saying that sex and bodily functions were dirty or sinful. It is noteworthy that while the normal sexual process between a husband and wife made both parties ceremonially unclean, it did not make them sinful. No guilt was involved. No sacrifice was required. So the chronic discharge, which required a sin offering, was not necessarily related to personal sin. All right. What we've done so far is look at the requirements of a man who had a bodily discharge. Perhaps in one case, disease, and in another case, the normal function of the man. The rest of the passage turns its attention to female discharge. So it says in verse 19, if a woman has a discharge and the discharge from her body is blood, she shall be set apart 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. Everything she lies on during her impurity shall be unclean. Also, everything that she sits on shall be unclean. Whoever touches her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And whoever touches anything that she sat on shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. If anything is on her bed or anything on which she sits, when he touches it, he shall be unclean until evening. Now, that part of the passage is just virtually identical to what it was said about the men. Only in this case, it's talking about her monthly menstrual cycle. And during that time, she was ceremonially unclean. And the process for her was like it was for the male. What she touches is unclean, ceremonially. It gets interesting. Verse 24. And if a man lies with her so that her impurity is on him, he shall be unclean 7 days, and every bed on which he lies shall be unclean. Oh, boy. Listening to my messages on Leviticus online said he was thankful that he wasn't living under the Mosaic law. And this gets to be a case in point. So a woman was not to go anywhere near her husband for 7 days. Wow. Now, all kinds of commentaries get just, when this kind of stuff comes up in the Bible, they just go crazy with all kinds of speculation. Let me tell you what one of them said. By placing the woman in what amounted to a state of isolation, the legislation made it possible for her to enjoy some retrieve from her normal duties and gave her an opportunity for renewing her energy. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I just thought it was interesting that she gets a break from, she can't touch anything, so she gets a break. Another said, the law appears to be very harsh to modern readers. It appears to consign virtually every woman in Israel to a state of being untouchable for a week each month. Some authorities, however, believe that the women in ancient Israel had menstrual periods far less frequently than modern women. They believe that earlier marriage, later weaning up to age 2 or 3, and the prevalence of large families made their unclean periods far more infrequent. Those most affected by the law were probably unmarried teenage girls. The result would have been that God-fearing young men would have been weary of making physical contact with them. This law then would have had effect on curbing the passions of the young. End of quote. Another interesting suggestion by a commentator who was trying to explain all of this. Whatever the reason, that's the law. Now, I said there are four cases, two for men, two for women. We've seen two for men. We've seen one for women. There's one more. This is for women. And this time, it's not her normal monthly menstrual cycle. It is a continuous menstrual cycle. So look at verse 25. If a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, other than her time of customary impurity, or if it runs beyond her usual time of impurity, all the days of her unclean discharge shall be as the days of her customary impurity. She shall be unclean. All right, this is describing not the normal experience, but an abnormal experience. If you will recall, the New Testament talks about a woman who had an issue of blood. Do you remember that? I remember preaching through the Gospels and coming to that. And what that meant is she had a continuous flow. And according to the Mosaic law, you can see that rendered her ceremonially unclean and radically restricted her activity. I remember preaching on that and talking about this is more than physical for her, that it had spiritual ramifications. She couldn't participate in any kind of spiritual worship. It had social ramifications. It had marital ramifications. If she had this kind of a problem, it was really, really serious. So, but that's the Mosaic law. If that's what was happening, she was unclean. Now, pick it up at verse 27. Every bed on which she lies all the days of her discharge, which he just said could be many, shall be to her as the bed of her impurity, her normal flow. And whatever she sits on shall be unclean, as the uncleanness of her impurity. Whoever touches her, those things should be unclean. He shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. But if she cleanses from her discharge, is cleansed from her discharge, then she shall count for herself 7 days, and after that she shall be clean. On the eighth day, she shall take for herself 2 turtle doves and 2 young pigeons and bring them to the priest to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the priest shall offer the one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering, and the priest shall make atonement for her before the Lord for the discharge of her uncleanness. So the priest was to offer 1 turtle dove and 1 pigeon as a sin offering and the one for a burnt offering, and making an atonement for her before the Lord. All right. I don't know what else you say about this. It's the same kind of thing we've seen throughout the chapter. There are several more verses in this chapter, and for lack of a better word, I think we could call them just a summary of what he has taught. So he says in verse 31, "Thus you shall separate the children of Israel from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness when they are defiled. My tabernacle that is among them, they shall defile my tabernacle which is among them." Now, I've been saying throughout this, they couldn't participate in any kind of worship pertaining to the tabernacle. And that was because I knew we were going to get to this verse. Someone has said verse 31 explains the reason for these regulations. God gave them so Israelites would not fall into the serious sin because of ignorance of how they were to behave when unclean. The rules about bodily discharge help the Israelites appreciate the seriousness of intermarriage with the Canaanites and the prohibition against foreign customs and religions which conflicted with Israel's holy living. God discouraged certain acts by designing them as resulting in uncleanness, which undoubtedly proved helpful in the area of private morality, where legal sanctions are not as effective as in public life. And again, I think this is putting its finger on the pulse of what's going on here. Clearly, this is different. And that means you're different from the others. And all kinds of suggestions in here. This could prohibit intermarriage. Canaanite might not want to marry somebody that had to go through all of this. And there are other possibilities as well. The chapter ends in verse 32 and 33. It says, "This is the law of one who has a discharge, and for him who has admitted semen and is unclean thereby, and for who is disposed because of her customary impurity, and one who has a discharge, either man or woman, and for him who lies with him who is unclean." So, the sexual processes thus made men and women unclean, but not that's not the same as saying they were sinful. Uncleanness established the boundaries of their action. But as long as they had not committed any sin outside of this, they were not guilty. Ever heard a Bible study in your life like that? Told you, you will not forget this Bible study. All right, here's the sum. The Israelites were to be different than other religions of men and women concerning bodily discharges, as well as other things they touched during the time. They were all considered unclean, prohibiting them from participation in the tabernacle, and for that matter, touching one another. All right. What do you do with that? Well, I think one thing you could do with that is say, thank God I'm not under the Mosaic law. I mean, that's one possibility. Someone said, God was teaching the household of faith the distinction between physical and holy. Anything connected with sexual function was part of the physical world. It was categorized as common, not holy. Sex could never be brought into the sanctuary. For unlike the Canaanite view, sexual activity was not a way to enhance spirituality or commune with God. But we need to quickly add, sin is wrong that's done to God. But ceremonial uncleanness was a condition that, while related to sin, was not sin itself. Sin separated the person further from God than uncleanness did. These unclean conditions did not result in the sinfulness of the Israelite, but in his or her disqualification from public worship in the nation. Jesus' attitude toward law about bodily uncleanness was the same as his attitude toward food laws, which is spelled out in Matthew chapter 15. When he came, he announced the end of their authority because God would open the church to Jews and Gentiles equally. These Israelite laws separated the Jews from the Gentiles by illustrating Israel's unique function in God's program, which ended temporarily until the millennium with the death of Christ. And again, that author is putting his finger on what I think is critical here, and that is what this amounts to is you are different. You don't do what the Gentiles do. You are, well, not sinful, but unclean. And you're going to stay that way until you wash, you clean up. So, the question is this. Is there a category of unclean things for Christians today? That's what we ought to think about. Under the new covenant, there are only sinful and non-sinful things. Even though sometimes not sinful things should not be a good idea, they're not sinful. The New Testament talks about those kinds of things. So, let me talk about that for a second. Now, think about this for just a minute. Here are some activities that are not sinful. We all agree on that? Sex is not sinful between a man and his wife. A woman's monthly cycle is not sinful. But it rendered her unclean. So, the question is there anything comparable to that in the New Testament? That is something that is not sinful, but you may choose not to participate in it. Is that distinction clear? For example, Paul says, all things are lawful to me, but all things are not expedient. So, they have an issue with eating meat offered to idols. And Paul makes very clear, there's absolutely, positively nothing wrong with eating meat offered to an idol. However, under some circumstances, you shouldn't eat it. That's a very fascinating passage. It's 1 Corinthians 8 through 10. And what he says is, look, if you want to go to the market and buy some meat offered to an idol, go home and enjoy it. If you go to somebody's house and they're serving, don't ask. Just eat it and enjoy it. But if a weaker brother, somebody who says, if you eat it, I'll eat it, but they have a conscience. It's not a legalistic brother that's just trying to judge you if you eat it. It's if you eat it, they eat it. It's very critical. It's very clearly spelled out in 1 Corinthians 8. Then he says, don't eat it. Don't destroy your brother. So there's a case where there's something not sinful, but you shouldn't do. In that same regard, Paul says, all things are lawful to me, but I'll not be brought under the power of any. I'm not going to do anything that's going to have control over me. I had an illustration of that early in my Christian life. It's going to sound silly to some. It was very serious to me at the time. Not long after I became a Christian, I woke up one morning and I had a headache. I don't have headaches. In my entire life, I've never had problems with headaches. I can count on my fingers the number of times I had it. I had a headache. And my mother said, did you drink your coffee? And I said, no. And she said, go drink a cup of coffee. So I drank a cup of coffee and the headache went away. And I said to my mother, let me get this straight. I drink coffee every morning. And you're telling me that if I miss it one morning, I get a headache? She said, yep, you're addicted to it. That day, I gave up caffeine. Now, that didn't mean that I didn't drink coffee. It meant that I didn't do it 2 days in a row. I'm serious. So for the rest of my life, I would never drink caffeine in any form. Diet Coke, which I love. I drank that stuff by the gallons years ago. But anything with caffeine in it, including tea, I would not drink successfully for a number of days in a row, but periodically I would do it. Now, some of you know I had a problem with AFib, that my heart would go out of rhythm. I am persuaded that caffeine did it. I dropped my little rule, and 1 weekend I was extremely busy. And I virtually didn't eat anything for, I think, 2 or 3 days, or I didn't eat much. But I lived on Diet Coke. And that was the first time I had an episode of AFib. And I have since had a little procedure called an ablation, and they're convinced that I'm probably done with that. I don't even take any drugs anymore to prevent it. But you know what? I don't drink caffeine now in any form, at any time, under any circumstances. Now, I'm taking that to an extreme, but I'm trying to illustrate the point. I'll not be brought under the power of anything. It's going to control me. I'm not going to do it. I don't think I've ever told that story, maybe once publicly, because I think if I started making that a rule and put it on everybody else, that becomes legalism, and that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to simply obey that command that applies to me, and it might not apply to you. So this is not a sermon against caffeine, okay? The sermon is against, there are things not sinful that are not wise. Make sense? Fill in the blank. But the other lesson in this chapter, the one I think is the lesson of the chapter, is that we are different. I think that's really getting at the reason that the Lord gave these stipulations to begin with, and I would say it's the predominant explanation among the people who grapple with this passage. So let me end by talking about that for a second. Are we different? Are Christians supposed to be different?
Yes.
How? Well, I could spend hours talking about all the ways that we are different. But I want to share with you, again, a personal experience. I said at the beginning, I got saved in a Baptist church in the South many years ago. And they weren't real bad about it, but they still had their list of don'ts. You know, I think at the beginning I called them the Filthy Five, the Nasty Nine, and the Dirty Dozen. And really, I was told, it was sinful to play cards. And I remember I got saved as a senior in high school. Prior to that, I went to a movie every weekend. And they told me movies were sinful, so I gave up movies. You know, but it was all preached under the guise of you're separated from the world. You're different. Well, I bought that I should be separated from the world. But it bothered me about where does the Bible talk like that? I mean by that, give a list of things, like going to a movie. By the way, did you know somebody in the ancient world taught that you shouldn't go to movies? They said that? All right, it wasn't a movie, it was a theater, same thing. Did you know somebody in the ancient world taught that you shouldn't go to movies? You know who it was? Paul? Nope. Peter? Nope. Moses? Nope. Jesus? Nope. Socrates said, the theater corrupts the youth of Athens. Oh. When I found that out, I thought, well, how am I supposed to be different? How am I supposed to expose my difference? Would you like to know? You might say yes, but after I show you, you might wish you hadn't. You want to know? What I was looking for was a passage that said, you're different from the unsaved, and here's how. That's what I was looking for. I wanted a passage that said that, and then I wanted to see what kind of thing it talked about. Aha! I found it. Philippians chapter 2. Turn to Philippians chapter 2. Oh, this is wicked. Oh, this is really bad. Convicting, I mean. Look at Philippians chapter 2, verse 14. Do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you shine as lights in the world. Did you see that? Now let me ask you a question. How many people did you hear today complain? A few? Maybe I should ask, how many times a day did you complain? Now let me just tell you, God has a very dim view of complaining. If you doubt that, read the book of Numbers and look at the word murmuring. He takes a very dim view of complaining. So Paul says, look, you should not be complaining, and you shouldn't get into any kind of dispute, because you're different. That's what the unsaved do. And you're not like them. You're different. How am I different? Well, it's very clear. I'm to shine as a light because I don't complain. Wow. That's the way we're different. There's a whole lot more. We should be characterized by gratitude and praise instead of complaining and disputing. We're different. Father, thank you. Thank you, Father, for giving us such a clear opportunity to demonstrate not our self-righteousness, not our superiority, but the fact that we're your children. And as your children, we're grateful and we render praise to you. Now, Father, help us, especially in the context of people that don't know you, to manifest that spirit of gratitude instead of the spirit of complaining. In Jesus' name, amen.